This audio file is a production of the Center for Health Administration Studies at the University of Chicago's School of Social Service Administration. Visit us on the web at chas.uchicago.edu.
So I'm super excited to be here today and really excited to talk to you about my more recent work on the impact of Medicaid expansion on the financial well-being of low-income adults. I started my career as a medical social worker working in an emergency department. And really, you know, in the emergency department, the intersection of health and poverty is so obvious. And it's long been an ambition of mine to be able to get, you know, deeper into where these two things intersect, and this work represents that. The impetus for this study is trying to get at the relationship between health and poverty. And backing out a little bit, it's important to consider that health and poverty changes over time. I mean, if you just take a lifespan approach, people tend to be healthier when they're younger, and they tend to get unhealthy as they age. And people have different times of their life where they might be exposed to poverty. And poverty can impact health, and health can impact poverty. And yet, it's been very hard for researchers to study that intersection. We have a few longitudinal studies, but you have to hope that they ask the right questions at the right time, and often that's not the case. And so I think it's really difficult sometimes as researchers to try to capture that moment where somebody's health might impact their income and where it might impact their standard of living and their well-being, or when being in a high poverty situation can impact your health. And so still just trying to get at that and running up against data limitations all the time, but I think that as, you know, more and more people get on the Medicaid program, we're going to have a better understanding of how these things work, intersect over time. So being uninsured has long been considered a reason why people might experience disparate health outcomes. People in poverty are more likely to be uninsured. I don't know if that's actually the case anymore in Medicaid expansion states, probably, but it has long been shown in the research that the poorer you are, the more likely you are not, you're not going to have employer-sponsored insurance. And so the policy context that you're probably all aware of was the Affordable Care Act Medicaid expansions in 2014 and Marketplace expansions also in 2014. And the SCOTUS decision, if you're not aware, was a decision by the Supreme Court to make Medicaid expansion optional. And to me, this brings us to one of the greatest polity inequities in our country, which is that in states that didn't expand Medicaid, if you make a little bit more money, you can get almost fully subsidized private health insurance through the marketplace. And if you're poor and your state didn't expand Medicaid, then you don't qualify for the subsidies if you're below 100% of federal poverty level and you remain uninsured. So when you think about the ACA as a tool to reduce health disparities, this decision and the differential expansion of Medicaid kind of reintroduces this opportunity to have enduring health disparities. And so when I, the research that I've done on Medicaid, one of my primary objectives is to inform states that have not yet expanded Medicaid about why they might want to do so, or, concerns that they might have, things that they could do to improve the program if they did. The reason why we're focusing on, in these papers, payday borrowing and evictions is these are both adverse financial outcomes for low-income people. They are disproportionately affected by it. So if, you are low-income, you're more likely to experience an eviction. You're more likely to go to a payday lender. Research by the Pew Charitable Trust has found that lower-income people are 60% more likely to use payday loans. So it's a problem that disproportionately affects them, but it also has all sorts of implications for their well-being and their health. If you lose your housing, that could disrupt your ability to go to work. It could put you in dangerous living environments. You could become homeless. Also, if you have a big health crisis, that could make it hard for you to work, and then you could be put into poverty and be more likely to be evicted. And with payday loans, which I'll talk about a little bit more in depth, they can cause real trouble for people in terms of getting back on their feet financially. So that's why we picked these things, and we have reason to believe that Medicaid might actually make a difference. So some mechanisms, you know, and part of me is like, oh, this is like from the center of the patently obvious. You know, a lot of my research feels like that way, like, oh boy, you wouldn't guess, but I understand that this is obvious, but if you're ever going to do a study design, you have to kind of say why you think something will happen. So I'm going to walk you through why I think this will happen, and I apologize for how obvious it is. So if you have Medicaid and you get sick and you need care, and you will pay less for it than if you have to pay for it out of pocket. And there's a lot of kinds of care that people use when they're uninsured. That they are required to pay for before they're able to use it. Urgent care is often, you know, if you're uninsured, they want you to pay a set price for your visit before you come in. And I think another really good example is prescriptions. So say you manage to get access to care through some way, and maybe they're willing to bill you, you still have to go to the pharmacy and you have to lay that cash down. So what we know is that Medicaid provides a very good pharmacy benefit, and we would expect that people that get Medicaid will not have to spend that much money and that they would have that money for other things. And the money that you save from not spending that out-of-pocket payments and the money that you might get from increased wages can be reinvested in your life. In terms of thinking about evictions, it could be reinvested in housing stability. In terms of thinking about health, it could be reinvested in nutrition. There's all sorts of mechanisms we could kind of think of where we would expect Medicaid to have a positive benefit in terms of these outcomes. So there's also prior evidence to support this relationship. So the Oregon Health Insurance Experiment found that Medicaid reduced out-of-pocket spending in general, but almost entirely eliminated catastrophic health exposure, which we defined as 30% of your income. It reduced financial strain, and that measure is like a really important measure. It's like, did you have to borrow money from friends and family? Did you have to skip paying some bills to pay other bills? Is that like robbing Peter to pay Paul? And it reduced your probability of being in collections, primarily because of medical collections, and if you were, you owed less. So that's one, you know, positive benefit we know from Medicaid and finances. There's also been studies on Medicaid and credit scores. What I like about those studies is that credit scores, like evictions and payday loans, can have real serious implications for low-income people. And what they found in this study is that health insurance improved people's credit scores to the extent that they got better credit offers. So the terms of credit that they engaged in were more favorable to them, and the authors estimated that that value was at $520 million per year. So think about that. You go to get a car and you're not paying a 10% interest rate. You qualify for a loan at 5% interest rate. These are the kind of what I think of as manifold consequences of either having a good financial health or bad financial health. And there's been several systematic reviews of the ACA expansions, and while there are some things that are contradictory, one of the consistent findings is that Medicaid is good for people financially. And there has been studies on medical-related bankruptcy that showed that insurance is protective of medical bankruptcy. There was a recent study to say that maybe it's not quite as big a problem as we previously thought, but there is still a literature to support that. And so the research questions that I'm going to share with you today and the studies that I'm going to present are on those two questions. Could Medicaid impact payday borrowing? And could Medicaid prevent eviction? So what we decided to do is to focus on California's early Medicaid expansion. There's strengths and weaknesses to that. But we follow the kind of methodology set by Ben Sommers and colleagues in a 2014 Health Affairs article where they list the dates of expansion. California expanded over a period of time from 2011 to 2012, and they did it on a county-by-county basis, and not all counties expanded early, though most of them did. And that variation allows us to consider what the impact of Medicaid expansion might be on later expanding states. There's about 3.8 million Californians who gained coverage during this early expansion. Payday loans are specifically for people that are working and can demonstrate that they have money coming in. About 12 million people had a payday loan in the last, number I was able to find, which was 2012. Now, to be clear, it's not that people can take money out of your paycheck if you don't pay it. It's just some way of demonstrating that you have income, and then you apply for a loan, and you're still responsible to pay for it. But the assumption is if you can demonstrate you have a paycheck coming in, then payday lenders will assume they're getting paid. And the loans are pretty small, between $300 and $500, and they are supposed to be paid back in 2 weeks. And they usually have a set fee per $100 that's lended. And while this is not a great outcome, and we do look at this, you can roll that over generally. So it's the end of your two-week period, and you're like, I don't have enough cash to pay this. And they're like, well, we can issue you a new loan, give you an extra $50 today to bring you to this, and then you have to pay it 2 weeks after that. And this is where, when you think of like a debt spiral, where this can start to really happen. They are very expensive when you consider it at APR level. The percent is usually 300 to 400%, which is way above what you would pay with a credit card. When you give people information about what the costs really are, they often choose not to take it, which tells you that it's kind of a loan of last resort. When people understand what they're getting themselves into, they recognize that it's not ideal. They're advertised as like, we're here for you when you have an emergency, but that is not how people use them. In a survey of payday borrowers, the Pew Charitable Trust found that like 70% of people were not using them for an emergency, but were using them for reoccurring monthly expenses. You can see why that would be problematic, right? You're going to have to pay that same amount next month. So how is next month going to be different from this month if you don't have enough money to make ends meet? And payday borrowers tend to borrow frequently. A lot of people don't like payday loans. Payday lending is a practice. There's been a lot of initiatives from a policy level to do away with them. And there's good reason to be concerned about them as, kind of a financial option for low-income people. The thing about unexpected expenses versus routine expenses is healthcare can be either, right? When you think about why health might impact people's payday borrowing, you can have an emergency that means you have to suddenly come up with a certain amount of cash to buy a prescription, for example. Or you might have a monthly prescription cost that you just can't afford to pay. And every month you come into conflict between, do you pay your heating bill or do you get your prescription? And there is a long literature of low-income people skipping doses of their medication, taking half doses of their medication. And so we know this is a real barrier for people. In defense of payday lending, if you have bad credit, people aren't going to lend you money in the conventional banking sector. You can't come in and say, I'd like a personal loan. They're going to look at your credit score and they're going to say no. And so when you do need to come up with cash quickly, this is an option. And there has been some literature to suggest that alternative arrangements aren't any better. And I want you to consider checking accounts. If you write a check for $2 and it bounces, you're going to have a $25-ish fee. If you write 10 checks and they're all under $20, you're paying 100% in a penalty of what it is that you borrowed. So that quickly can become worse for people, and that actually is another strategy that low-income people employ to try to make things work. So I'm going to post date a check to the electric company and hope they don't deposit it until this date. I'm going to, post this check here, and then I'm going to go see if my mom will give me some money that I can deposit to cover it. So it can become very problematic, and in some ways I think that probably is worse for people than just taking out a payday loan because their fees can be much higher. And the last defense of payday lenders is that they aren't actually not as getting as rich as people think they are. I mean, there's this idea of they're a predatory lender. And, you know, that predatory, the beast, you know, like it's coming in and taking out the little guy. But if you look at the amount of money that they actually get back, they lose a lot of money. And that is what drives the fees up. So when you're giving money to a population that has a history of bad credit, there's the possibility that you're not going to get paid. And if you're not going to get paid, you have to recoup that money from somewhere. And where you recoup it is from new people that come and borrow money. So those are just some things to think about when we think about the policy implications. So the data that we received was from Clarity, CFSA. It's the Community Financial Services Association of America. And they are a business association for payday lenders. They collect data. They do federal advocacy. On behalf of payday lenders, they monitor changes in the policy. And they gave us a data set that was de-identified for the purposes of this research. And I have to say, they did not impose any restrictions on us whatsoever in terms of the research question we asked or the findings. We didn't have to run any of our papers by them for their feedback before publishing. And so, you know, we're really grateful for that. The data set that we got was from 2009 to 2014 and contained the universe of the five largest payday lending chains that had locations in multiple states. And the time period we have is approximately 2 years before and after California's initiated their Medicaid expansion. For each loan, we know we have an encrypted social security number, which allows us to look at multiple borrowing patterns. We know when they got the money and when they were supposed to repay the money. We know the zip code of where the storefront was at, and we know whether, you know, what happened after they got the loan. And our approach was a standard difference in difference design, where primary outcomes is we wanted to look at how many loans people took out by how many unique borrowers and how much they borrowed. And then we had some secondary outcomes, and that's the number of people who default, the number of people who pay late, the number of people who roll it over into a new loan, and then the number of loans each person took. We stratify, we focus on people under the age of 65 because those are the people impacted by the Medicaid expansion, and we stratify it because most of California's enrollment was a younger population rather than older. So 80% were under the age of 55, and half of them were under the age of 50. So we wanted to look, because one of the, you know, we don't have a lot of variables to work with here, and so we're trying to get at as much as possible something that would allow us to specify that relationship between Medicaid and the outcomes. So we would expect that we would have a greater impact among younger people based on the demographics of who enrolled in Medicaid in California. And then we also stratify by counties because we would expect that there would be a bigger impact in counties that had a larger share of uninsured prior to the expansion. And then we do what's called a triple difference in difference, where we compare those over the age of 65. So we look at Medicaid expanding counties compared to non-expand counties over time, comparing those over age 65 to people under age 65. When we look by the age of borrowers, what we see is that it's entirely driven by people who are younger. The 50 to 64 does not reach statistical significance, and the reduction is concentrated among those between the ages of 18 and 49. Prior to the expansion, the trends in Medicaid expansion counties was very similar to the trends in non-expanding counties, and then after, about 6 months after the expansion, you start to see this downward trend in Medicaid expanding counties compared to those that didn't. So this is very reassuring in terms of our methodology that the approach was appropriate and okay. When we look by the age of borrowers, what we see is that it's entirely driven by people who are younger. The 50 to 64 does not reach statistical significance, and the reduction is concentrated among those between the ages of 18 and 49, which is kind of what we see with the Medicaid expansion. So that's also kind of reassuring that that the enrollment trends seem to match the trends in the reduction of payday borrowing. When we look at people with the share, previous share uninsured, we also see that it's the people in the high tercile of previously uninsured where we see the biggest reductions in payday borrowing. You can see, you know, just comparing high versus low, that the magnitude of reduction is consistently greater in these areas where there were people that would have benefited from a Medicaid expansion. So in summary, our main results, we believe that Medicaid expansion is associated with a reduction in the use of payday loans. We see the effect is larger among younger borrowers and in areas where they previously had more uninsured. When we look at secondary outcomes, things get a little crazy. We see that the age went down of the borrower a little bit, which you wouldn't totally expect. It's a statistically significant difference, but I don't know how much of a meaningful difference it is in terms of actual differences in age. We see the share of defaults go up. We see the share of late payments go up, and we see the share of rollovers go up while the number of loans per borrower goes down. The sensitivity test with older borrowers, we actually see that among people over the age of 65, borrowing goes up in Medicaid in California counties, Medicaid expanding counties relative to non-Medicaid expanding counties. And when we look at the triple difference specification, you definitely see this relationship between people under age 65 having the reduction in comparison to people over the age of 65. So this, you know, my hypothesis might be that this might be what California trends would have been if there hadn't been Medicaid expansion, that maybe there was just a general increase. There would have been a general slow increase in payday borrowing in California in the absence of it. Alternative explanations, I mean, are really hard to kind of grasp at. Was there some new program that just impacted the elderly? Was there some new cost structure related to something? I don't know. But you definitely, you see the increase among people who are older than 65, and you see the large reduction among those under age of 65. So, you know, we, to the best of our ability, feel like we were able to try to answer this question. It would be fantastic if there were a data set that allowed us to actually look at people's coverage and look at that relationship to payday loans. As far as we know, there's no such data set that exists. So, it's funny to live in a world where there is so much data. But when you want to answer a question that seems like it should be a reasonable question, there's no data. And so I think this is suggestive, but absolutely it would be great if there were an ability to somehow link administrative Medicaid records with payday lending. You would need to get some kind of agreements in there with evictions, as we'll talk about. Like, that seems like it's even more possible because you have address-based information. But with payday lending, it's very difficult. Now, the reason why we, you know, the issue of the secondary outcomes where you see increases, our only hypothesis related to that is that it might change the composition of borrowers. So people who might be borrowing for health care related reasons might be fundamentally different than people who borrow because they're underemployed or, you know, have a substance abuse problem or any other myriad of issues. And so that might be a higher risk population than people who are borrowing because of trying to fill routine prescriptions or because they had some kind of health shock. I think that also warrants future research. So, you know, as somebody who studies social policy entirely because I want to influence decision-making and policy, the question is did it have any impact on policy? And the answer is complicated. So we got a tweet out from Dianne Feinstein. We, you know, the article was shared a lot. My favorite is that we had 26,000 upvotes on Reddit. Very exciting until you read the comments. And once you read the comments, you despair for humanity because people are having this entire scientific debate about the article and nobody has read the article. So, no. I mean, the paper was shared, though, in the Commuter Financial Advisory Board. And I think that, you know, that's the best we can hope for at this point. I think from a policy perspective, I would like people to recognize that Medicaid is not just a health policy. but that Medicaid is also in many ways an anti-poverty policy. And I think when people are looking at the costs and benefits of Medicaid, they often do focus entirely on the healthcare system. A lot of states use the Oregon experiment results in a way to suggest that Medicaid is not good value for the money because we did not find any change in blood pressure, cholesterol, obesity, a lot of the things that we had thought that maybe we would 2 years after people gained coverage. And the narrative around that kind of became Medicaid is not good health insurance, Medicaid is not working. And yet one of the important benefits of health insurance is to protect people from financial harm, you know, these catastrophic exposures, and also to give them predictable healthcare expenses. And I think that, I don't know if people really believe this, but I get a sense from the policy, the way that policies are made, that there's this belief that low-income people don't have any finances to protect. You know, like you can't get blood from a stone. So they're charity care anyway. You know, they're not paying their bills anyway. And yet low-income people do have finances to protect, and they're precarious. And so, and things like payday lending, well, I do see the purpose of having somewhere that people can go when they have no other options to pay bills that they have to pay. I do see that argument. It can cause people to go into a debt spiral. You keep rolling these loans over and paying more and more fees, and you have the same amount of income coming. Like, where are you going to take that money from? And so my hope from a policy perspective is that we can broaden the conversation about Medicaid to include these benefits that traditionally have been lumped more into benefits related to earned income tax credit or benefits related to TANF. And I think that there are more and more studies coming out to support that, and so that's kind of my goal. I haven't seen that happen per se, but I'm always hopeful. Right, like we do the work because we hope that people will read it and respond to it. And any legislature that wants me to come and present, I would happily do so on my own dime, because I think it's important information to consider.
Thank you for joining us during the first part of Dr. Heidi Allen's lecture regarding the spillover effects of Medicaid expansion on financial stability among low-income families. In part two, Dr. Allen will discuss her most recent research regarding the effects of Medicaid expansion in relation to evictions among low-income Americans. For more information about our Michael Davis lecture series, visit us on the web at chas.uchicago.edu.